WIOX is supported by the following community underwriters. Watershed, Roxbury's Coffee Shop and Cafe on Main Street in historic Roxbury. Open every day from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. for coffee, pastries, fresh, casual food. And on Friday and Saturday evenings from 5 to 8 p.m., dinner by 808 Catering and full bar service. Watershed, Main Street in Roxbury. WatershedRoxbury.com and on Instagram at WatershedRoxbury. Restless Works, a contemporary architectural, interior, and graphic design studio specializing in residential, commercial, and hospitality projects, as well as branding, marketing, and apparel, and web design. Based in Andes, Restless Works does projects throughout the Catskills, the Hudson Valley, and New York City. More information at 845-676-6190. 845-676-6190 or restlessworks.com. Vly Mountain Spring Water, delivering fresh, pure spring water from the heart of the Catskill Mountains to homes and businesses from Kingston to Saugerties, Roxbury to Delhi, Walton to Ellenville, New Paltz to Rosendale. 5-gallon bottles of spring water and dispensers for sale or rental. Vly Mountain Spring Water, 845-254-6508 or vlymountainspringwater.org. The Arc Bowl and Barbecue, Route 28 in Arkville, New York. A 120-seat, restored 1960s-era vintage 8-lane bowling alley, barbecue joint, saloon, and music entertainment venue. Featuring a slow, smoked and grilled barbecue menu. The Arc Bowl and Barbecue, available for all types of social events, including weddings, birthday parties, and work gatherings. Details at thearcbowl.com.
Hi, I'm Nathaniel Hitchcock, host of Liberal Arts Audio, where we host interviews with artists, curators, designers, and filmmakers, music, and sound art. Alternate Tuesday afternoon from 1 to 2 p.m. right here on WIOX Roxbury Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC Cable Channel 20, and WIOXRadio.org.
Okay, you are listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, and at 107.5 FM on the campus of SUNY Delhi on smart devices through the Radio FM app, and everywhere at WIOXradio.org, where it's easy to donate. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John, how's it going?
Things are good. How are you?
Been well. Just grinding up some venison. I guess you're getting ready to do the same thing again?
Yep. That's tonight's project after this radio show. Make some sausage.
All right. That's good.
Yeah. So what are you seeing in the woods?
What am I seeing in the woods? Not much. No. I haven't been out that much in the last couple of days.
Yeah.
But yeah.
You know, I haven't gone for very many walks in the woods in the last week, but I am cutting some red maple, giving back to those deer after a long season. It's the way I give back to them.
Yeah, that's good.
Cut my firewood, 3 or 4 trees a week, and by the end of February, I got my firewood down, and they've got plenty of food on the forest floor.
Yeah. I bought a new chainsaw. My last one blew up, so I just like saying it blew up.
Kapow.
Pow.
Yeah, meltdown. Darn.
That's right.
Well, did you get enough use out of it where you're not, where you're happy with it?
Yeah. I bought another one.
No, oh, good.
No, I love that saw. It's a good one. So tonight we got a full show, and tonight's topic is fire suppression and mesification of upland oak landscapes with Dr. Heather Alexander. She is an assistant professor of forest ecology at Auburn University and forest and fire ecologist whose research focuses on understanding ecosystem vulnerability in the face of climate change and altered disturbance regimes, especially fire. Her research includes effects of wildfire severity on forestry structure and carbon dynamics in the Siberian Arctic and the implications of fire suppression and mesification on oak forests of the eastern United States. Before Auburn, Heather was an associate professor in the College of Forest Resources at Mississippi State University. She earned her doctorate in biology from the University of Kentucky and was a postdoctoral fellow of forest ecosystem ecology at the University of Florida. And let me see if I can get her on. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Are you okay?
Yes, we can hear you. First of all, where is Auburn? Is that Alabama? Where is that?
Auburn University. We're in the SEC, and we are located in Auburn, Alabama. We're about 1.5 hours southwest of Atlanta.
All right. What's the weather like down there today?
It's chilly today. So we had a front come through, I guess, the night before last, and this morning we actually dropped down below freezing. So that was pretty chilly for us.
Are you from the south? I see Florida. I see Mississippi, and now Alabama. So are you from down there?
I'm from Texas originally.
Holy cow. Jeez.
I'm circling the southeastern U.S. right now, but my husband's from New York, so I'm kind of familiar with the region you guys are up in.
Oh, no kidding. What part?
He's from Staten Island, but he went to Oneonta for college.
Okay. Oneonta's in the Catskill Mountains, so, yep.
Not too far away from you guys, and I've got some good colleagues up at Colgate University in Hamilton.
All right. Yeah, that's definitely in our backyard. So if you could summarize today's talk, mesification might be a new term for a lot of people, I would imagine. It's not like on the radar. How would you describe that?
So mesification is a term that was first coined by Mark Abrams at Penn State and Greg Nowacki, Forest Service, to describe a process where forests that have had fire intentionally removed from them sort of progressively become more dominated by species that don't like fire. So they tend to be more shade-tolerant species like red maple and sugar maple, American beech, or later successional, the trees that you typically see in older forest stands that don't have disturbances. And those trees have traits that create cooler, moister, and more shadier conditions in their understory that then continue to act as suppressed fire. So it's basically, sounds complicated, it's really not. Basically, like, these trees have really dense canopies, so they create a lot of shade, shady conditions. As we all know, when you walk through the forest, you have your favorite trees you stand under when it gets hot. You know, those shady conditions, it's cooler, prevent wind flow and evaporation. So the fuels or the leaf litter tend to be more moist, so they burn as well. And so as those trees become more and more dominant in forests, then it's harder for the fire to get in there and to be a disturbance and an ecological process in those forest stands.
That's intuitive, right? You know, that a species would want to promote more of itself or more of its species, right?
So that idea is really interesting to me, just that, that the trees themselves are sort of engineering an environment that's more conducive for their growth and survival and reproduction, than it would be for another tree, like maples and beech, create those shady conditions, and they're fine in those conditions, and they stop fire because they don't like it.
You're breaking up a little bit. I don't know if you can move to a spot where it's got a little better.
Let me move over by the window here and see if that helps. I'm in my office.
Yeah, that probably works. You know?
Right.
I can hear you a little bit. Say it again.
Yeah, so basically just trying, you know, it's interesting to think about how these trees can engineer an environment that's better for them than for other tree species.
Yeah, that's much better. So pre-settlement oaks. I remember reading this a long time ago by Mark Abrams, who has been on From the Forest a few years back, maybe more. And he talked about, you know, looking at, what is it, like fossil pollen or whatever, and seeing if oaks, you know, decline and increase. Does it have to do with climate? Although I thought I remember him saying they even increased during some cooler periods, which he thought was maybe due to anthropogenic fire, but I don't know. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so it's pretty interesting, actually, because, you know, we can derive pollen records from lake sediments, so we can take sediments out of lakes, and those sediments are preserved, and then we can section them by depth and then look at them under a very high-resolution microscope to see pre-pollen, and every species has a very distinct shape and color and texture to its pollen, so you can actually reconstruct what trees occurred across the landscape in different parts of the world based on these pollen records. And so it's sort of hard to imagine, but, you know, 10, 15,000 years ago, depending on where you were, a big chunk of the eastern U.S. was glaciated, and that glacier came down to about the Ohio River, and it was only about 15, 16,000 years ago that glacier started to retreat. So in Tennessee, for example, 15,000 years ago, you know, it wasn't oak forest. It was mostly pine and spruce because those are cold-loving species. And then as that glacier retreated, those species migrated north, and it became warmer and drier. And that's when you started to see an increase in abundance of more species like oaks, upland oaks, and pines that like those conditions. And so there were some oaks on the landscape before then, just not in as high of abundance. But they definitely like warmer, drier conditions. And now if you look at the pollen record, you know, in Tennessee, for example, which is where some of the best pollen records for the eastern U.S. come from, oak pollen is very, very dominant. And so there may have been some increases. I mean, there's definitely been changes in the Holocene in recent times and in oaks that have been that have occurred because of human activities, particularly burning by Native Americans and then European settlers and post-European settlement when we harvested a lot of sand and created a lot of disturbance. That's what oak trees or upland oak trees really like.
And so how are oaks doing today?
Yeah, great question, and that's something I spend a lot of my time thinking about and probably something that many of your listeners have actually thought about, too. So it's very interesting, and this is a trend that is pretty common across the eastern U.S., where if you go out and walk into a forest, say one of the national forests or state forests, and you look around, and you'll notice that in many places the overstory is dominated by oak, and you're like, okay, I'm in an oak forest. And then you might look down on the forest floor, and you'll notice acorns, and you'll notice a few oak seedlings, maybe some saplings. But really, if you start looking around eye height, you'll notice that there's very, very few oaks, and hardly any in the midstory. And so this is problematic, because now what we're mostly seeing in the midstory and many of these stands are species like sugar maple, red maple, black cherry, ash, the non-oak species. In some sites, maybe it would be oak and pine further south. But so what this means is you have a bottom. Lots of big oaks, lots of little seedlings, but those seedlings are not making it into the middle size classes. So sometimes this is referred to as the oak sapling bottleneck, which means that when these overstory oaks die, which many of them are 80, 100, maybe 120 years old, and so they'll start to finesse and die in the next decade, they won't be replaced by oaks. They're going to be replaced by these non-oak, more shade-tolerant species that have come into dominance in this era of fire suppression that began around the 1920s.
Okay. And this is called the oak sapling bottleneck, right? Is that's what I thought I saw in your presentation. And I'm referring to a presentation you gave for the, what is it, the Southern or the Fire Exchange? What was that you gave it to?
Yes. I gave a talk to the Southern Fire Exchange this past fall, and I think it was October. I can't remember exactly when.
Yeah, that's where I found it. Yeah, it's good talk. Yeah, the oak sapling bottleneck. Do you think our forests today are denser than they were 100 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's unquestionable, that if you walk into, I mean, based on everything that I've read, it seems like at the time of European settlement, oaks were, you know, represented about 30 to 80% of forest composition in the eastern U.S., with the highest dominance mostly in the central hardwood region and in the Appalachian region. And they were mostly open canopy forests and that had a regular low severity fires that came through. And the fires were spread by this herbaceous field bed. It was mostly grasses and low growing vegetation that was a fuel, but it created low intensity. And when you take fire out of that, you start to get a lot more trees coming in. And so those trees just get denser and denser and denser. And now what we have is we have oak forests, but they're mostly close canopy stands. So they're very, very dense. They have high basal area, but it's mostly because there's so many stems in them.
Okay.
So, yes.
Yeah. How would you define density? Because sometimes it's crown closure, sometimes it's basal area, which is like square footage of looking at round cylinders across the landscape. Right. How would you define density?
I think if you're describing it as trees per acre or basal area per acre or important value, which combine those two, it's definitely increasing.
Yeah.
Compared to what it was at the time of European settlement.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I wanted to have you on, because I think these are things we're seeing in the Catskills, right, John?
We see it all over. Yeah, across the state.
Yeah, especially in areas, Heather, where the escarpment is, where it meets the Hudson Valley, the mountains meet the big valley. All right, that's where you're going to have the central hardwoods, as we might call them up here, which is your oak, hickory, chestnut, which, you know, not as many chestnut, of course, meets the northern hardwood, the maple beech and yellow birch, black birch. And they're kind of dueling it out. And we know the northern hardwoods are winning, right, the shade tolerance. So we're kind of seeing this all the time in our visits to members or forest owners' properties.
Yeah. I mean, y'all are in a really interesting region because, you know, if you look at the historical or the maps of historical fire frequency across the continental U.S., New York is pretty dissected in terms of those numbers, because the northern reaches of the state, you know, where northern hardwoods have been there for a while, and they're not that flammable, right? And that was mainly driven by climate, because it was cool and moist, and that's where those trees like to grow. But then if you get further south and at escarpment that I think you're describing, the fire return intervals get to be, the historical ones are somewhere between like 12 and 20 years for the historical fire return interval, which is pretty frequent, really.
Yeah. Yeah, they were burned quite often. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I can remember being up there every time we go to New York. I'm like, man, this is a mess, because there's so much of that, like, weedy, cruddy stuff coming in the understory. And I just keep thinking, this place needs a fire.
Yeah. Try to convince everyone up here that.
Yeah. Not gonna happen. Red maple. If you want to see a fire, the best legacy of a pyrogenic landscape in New York State, if I had to think of one besides Long Island, would be the Shawangunk Ridge, which is
okay.
That's where you have the pitch pine, yeah, growing. Right. But now we're getting – so pitch pine is the most fire-tolerant, right? And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, and you have red spruce coming out of the swamps and starting to grow on those rocky hillsides next to pitch pine. That's just not right.
No. I wonder, I don't know much about red spruce, but I wonder how flammable it is. Do you guys know?
It's flammable. I mean, I burn it for when I'm camping, so I don't know. But pitch pine is too, but it just, well, you probably know better than I do, but it sprouts from the trunk after a fire. I've seen it do that. It's just a weird tree.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting.
It's like jack pine, I guess they call it north, but down by you, there's so many pines down there. I don't know them all. I just went to Florida, yeah. And I didn't know any of those pines.
I think there's only three or four that are really dominant down here, but this is definitely a pine-dominated system. Although Alabama is really interesting because we have the Appalachian Mountains, you know, in the northeast corner, and so you get into the upland hardwood systems that, you know, functionally and the way they look a lot like the forest up where you guys are.
Huh. Really? Can you make maple syrup there?
Jesus.
I don't know. I'd like to see how far south it goes.
You might be able to in some places. I don't think we have near as much sugar maple as you guys
in the
do.
Backyard setting.
I've looked it up. I know they're doing it in Tennessee because I've done web searches to see how far south, and I found like some kind of festival or whatever.
Well, I've never been to Alabama, so you got to paint me a picture of what we're looking at here.
Yeah. So, oh, go ahead.
You know, Alabama's really nice, actually. You know, we've got beaches, and then we've got longleaf pine ecosystems, which are incredible as fire-dependent forests. And then, like I said, you get up into the upland hardwood systems, and you've got Appalachian Mountains. You're really up in the mountains, which is fascinating. It's beautiful.
That's cool. Yeah. So I remember reading a long time ago there was an oak symposium or something in Arkansas, and they were talking about this, like, early 2000s or maybe more, about oak being replaced by mesic hardwoods or shade tolerance. Up by us, it seems to be red maple, sugar maple, a lot of American beech, some hemlock. What is it down south that the oaks are being replaced by?
It's the same. It's the same thing. I mean, red maple is like the poster child for mesification. And red maple, and part of it is because it's so ubiquitous. It's everywhere, right? It's in Florida, Alabama, Georgia. It's all over the place. So American beech is another one that we have a lot of. And then the other one that maybe isn't so much of an issue for you guys, but is real, although I know it grows up there, is sweet gum.
Yeah, that starts growing around Staten Island, where your husband's from. You start growing and getting into that. We don't have it up here.
That's one that we fight a lot down here, and it's especially problematic because it has a really prolific root sucker. So if you damage the roots, it spreads vegetatively.
Just gets mad, huh?
It gets mad. Kind of like sassafras, I think, does the same thing.
Yep, we have sassafras.
Yeah.
Especially in those fire-prone areas that used to burn. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is fire suppression and mesification of upland oak landscapes with Dr. Heather Alexander. So why should anyone care that oak is going away?
Well, great question. And I bet you have some hunters who listen to your show and probably understand that really intimate relationship between turkeys, deer, and acorns. And so I think that's one of the first things that everybody thinks about when we think about losing our oaks is what's going to be our hard mass species? What's going to feed these animals that we love to interact with recreationally, whether it's hunting or, you know, I mean, there's many, many other animals that depend on acorns, particularly during the winter for their food sources. Many, many birds, small mammals, and then our favorites, you know, white-tailed deer and turkey, black bear. You know, so I don't know what would replace it. You know, there's hickories, but they're in so much smaller abundance, American beech. But again, you know, nut production is not as consistent as a single species. I mean, we group oaks together, but when we talk about upland oaks, we're talking about, I think, you know, probably like 10 different species at least. And
yeah.
So that acorn food source is super important for our wildlife species, and I think that's the main thing. They also provide, you know, really unique litter, leaf litter. Their litter is very thick. It curls when it dries. It is decomposed and eaten by many different insects, especially, you know, the larvae of butterflies and moths. And those insects are eaten by animals in higher trophic levels. And so if those insects don't have their detritus food base or that leaf litter to eat, then they won't live and survive and be available to animals in higher trophic levels. And then, of course, you know, thinking about this relationship between fire and oaks, that litter is super important for spreading fire, those characteristics of being curly and, you know, being thick and having lots of lobing. All of those things are things that create a low-density fuel bed that helps, you know, oxygen get in between the leaves, and when the flame hits it, for that fire to spread. If it gets packed down by these thin leaves, maple, beech, then that, you know, moisture gets in there and fire just doesn't perpetuate across the landscape. So those are a few things. And then I also think a lot about stuff that maybe other people don't think about, but I've done a lot of work sort of characterizing, you know, what's the shape of the oak canopy compared to red maple? What's the bark like? How does this alter the way that water moves through the forest? And functionally, oaks, at least the several species that I've looked at, are really different than species like American beech and red maple in the way that they move water and nutrients through the forest. So lots of things will change if we lose our oaks.
Yeah, you talked about that in your talk about the shapes of trees and stem flow and through flow. Could you explain that? Like when water hits a maple tree, which is not tolerant of fire, it's a mesophyte, I guess we'd classify, and versus a red oak, which is, in some areas in the Catskills, that's like our only oak, by the way.
Right.
We don't have many.
Yeah.
Yeah, how does it differ? How does it influence moisture?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. If you, there's lots of variability in all of these things. Just want to say that. But most of the time, red maple or American beech, you look at the bark, for example, it's really thin and it's really smooth. And the canopy of those trees tend to be very dense, meaning lots of leaf area, lots of twigs, you know, where the branches start relative to the ground tends to be very low. And so when rain hits those trees, what tends to happen is the water gets funneled down the branches, down the trunk of the tree through a process called stem flow. And then that water is dumped basically in a very narrow region around the bole or the base of the trunk of the tree, at the base of the trunk. And so that thin bark is really, really good at funneling water. You may have even seen this when you walk through the forest. You know, you'll notice that tree barks are change color after a rainfall, and sometimes you'll see like a sheet of water flowing down the bark, in particular with these smooth bark species. And what I found with some of my research, and some of that I've collaborated with other people at Mississippi State, is that these smooth bark species can funnel, I mean, 10, 20, 30 times more water to their, you know, that area around the base of that tree than an oak. And what this means is that they're basically taking that water away from the rest of the forest and giving it to themselves. And so you can think that, you can imagine that this might be one mechanism that some of these moisture-loving trees were able to come out in more riparian areas into the uplands, is by being able to kind of feed themselves. And the other interesting thing is that it's not just water. That water is loaded with nutrients, because the water, as it comes down the branches and the trunk, it washes off nutrients that have been deposited, you know, through the atmosphere, or it leaches out nutrients and carbon from the bark on the stem and the trunk of the tree. So it's loaded with a lot of laid-out carbon and a lot of nutrients that that tree can use.
Yeah, I believe this because I've seen it on the forest floor, but I've been up in my tree stand before as a deer hunter, and I lean against a smooth bark tree, and it's raining soaking wet.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's a lot of water.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing, actually. When I was doing my dissertation research in the Daniel Boone National Forest in eastern Kentucky, you know, we had a rainfall event. I think it was about an inch of rainfall, and I had these collectors up on the trees to collect stem flow, and I had these, I think they were 30-gallon trash cans that were basically the collectors. That one rainfall event on a red maple that was about 12 inches in diameter collected that entire garbage can full of water, while scarlet oak and chestnut oak collected maybe a quarter of the garbage can in water.
So explain that. How did, when the water hits an oak, where is it going on the oak tree then instead?
So a lot of that water gets absorbed in the bark because the bark is much thicker and it's more corky. And so when water hits it, it actually absorbs into it. And this is kind of cool, too, because that's actually potentially a mechanism by which the tree protects itself from fire damage, right? And it's particularly, like, especially down here, I don't know when you guys conduct prescribed fires, but down here they're often within a couple days of a rainfall event because managers are worried about fires, you know, getting out of control. So they'll conduct them 2 or 3 days after a precipitation event. And so if you're doing that and the trees just absorb a bunch of water in its bark, that might be another way that it keeps itself from being damaged by fire, which is kind of cool to think about. But it absorbs a lot of it. And then the structure of the canopy of oaks, because they don't, the inclination of the branches is different, a lot of that water will drop off of the branches or just move through the canopy of the tree as through fall and then just get deposited on the forest floor.
All right, so that answers my, because that's what I was confused about in your presentation was, because I was like, wait a second, sugar maple has, some of them don't have smooth bark, especially as they age and mature, but you're right, they're not corky, sugar maple bark. It's not.
Yeah.
It's not corky, but I could see how oak is, though. That might be it.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is that it's important to recognize we tend to, you know, we just say oak, and I do this all the time, but, like, we've done studies across the oaks, and they do differ as well. There's some variation, you know, if you go, like, look at a white oak compared to a northern red oak compared to a black oak or a chestnut oak. No, they all have different bark, too. So the degree, there's variation within them, too. It's just so much more different if you look at an American beech or sugar maple or red maple, especially when they're younger. And that's a cool thing, too. One of my colleagues at Mississippi State, she did a stem flow study on mid-story red maple and oaks because that's where, you know, a lot of the red maples that we see are in that mid-story stage. And when they're mid-story size trees, the proportion of water they funnel stem flow is like substantially higher than oaks. And then if you start to do the math, computing how much more water that is per tree, when you have such high density of tree of red maple in the forest understory, it accounts to a lot of water. I can't remember the number, but pretty substantial.
Yeah, I mean, how much do you think? I mean, oak trees. There's some issues with the roots going on. What is it, Phytophthora? I don't know. There's a whole host of fungi that are attacking them. Do you think this densification and maples taking that water and putting it onto the forest floor, do you think that harms oaks at all? I don't know. I don't really answer this. This density on the ground, we know sunlight. They can't take too much competition for sunlight. But is there something else going on?
Great question. I mean, you're right. I think the obvious issues or the competition for light, like you just said, and the mesification that reduces fire that the oaks need. But maybe there are other things, too. There's been some cool studies looking at fungal associations, like positive fungal associations. You know, mycorrhizal, they call them mycorrhizae. They're different fungi that are symbiotic with trees that help them basically acquire water and nutrients. And oak and red maple have different mycorrhizal associations. So oak have what are called ectomycorrhizae. So the fungi actually form a sheath on the outside of the root. And then red maple, for example, has endomycorrhizae, where the fungus actually penetrates into their roots. And there's been some studies that shown that that when you have a lot of red maple, it moves more to endomycorrhizae in the soil, which could harm oak indirectly by decreasing the abundance of their positive symbiotic associations with these mycorrhizae. So there's all sorts of interesting indirect interactions, I think, that could be going on as well.
Yeah, I'm guessing there's something there. I mean, the roots are so unknown, you know, compared to the overstory portion of the tree.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know. We think about what we can see, you know?
Yeah.
Tend to dismiss the rest of it.
Totally. We're going to take a break. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Fire Suppression and Messification of Upland Oak Landscapes with Dr. Heather Alexander. And we got some more questions for her after the break. Bob Seger, and if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. Tonight's topic is fire suppression and messification of upland oak landscapes with Dr. Heather Alexander. So what is this relationship between oak and fire, and how is this hypothesis, you know, where are the gaps lie between fire, oak, and messification and all that? Oh, are you there? Did I lose her?
Oh,
okay.
Ryan.
Yes.
Sorry. I missed the last part of what you said. Sorry.
Yeah, so how does fire and oaks play into each other? And in your presentation with the Southern Fire Exchange, there was some, you know, challenges to this hypothesis. Do we just simply burn to bring back oaks, or is it more complicated than that?
Oh, it's way more complicated than that, unfortunately. I think for a long time... And a long time, I mean, maybe the last 20 or 30 years or so, we were hopeful that, you know, okay, well, we're having problems with oak regeneration. We know that oaks need fire. Maybe all we need to do is restore fire to these ecosystems, and we'll get oaks back. So over the last couple of decades, there's been a ton of studies that have tried to do this. And what we have found in general is that, you know, putting a single fire back into an oak forest does absolutely nothing. Can actually just upkill a lot of these unwanted species like red maple and make them resprout prolifically. Multiple fires, sometimes, you know, if you put a, you can put a, put fire in at a pretty high frequency the beginning, so maybe every 2 or 3 years to knock back competition, but again, do it multiple times to kind of reduce the resprouting capacity of red maple and some of these other undesired species that are coming in. But the issue is that it's really hard to do anything that helps oaks unless you have a simultaneous or you time it with an overstory opening. So oaks need light. They're pretty shade intolerant, and even if you put multiple fires into these closed canopy stands that we see now, you're not going to open up the canopy enough to improve the conditions for oak enough. And then it's tricky because you can't open it up too much, because then you just improve conditions for these early successional, really light-loving species. So that's why sometimes, clear-cutting is problematic, because, the oaks might do well, but then so does, yellow poplar and black locust and all this other stuff that just grows quickly and then outcompetes those oaks. And so, what a lot of people do is, if they have some advanced oak regeneration in their stands, they'll put fire in at a pretty high frequency at the beginning to knock back competition. And then, they'll use a shelterwood method where they'll open up the canopy a little bit, usually by a mid-story removal, increase light enough to get those oaks to grow and get them into a more competitive position so that they aren't caught killed by or damaged by fire later on, and then later put fire back into the system. But it's sort of this, we've struggled with this a lot trying to do research, because it's really hard to get a fire of the intensity that you need to get rid of or to knock back competition during the dormant season, which is when most of the prescribed fires are being conducted. You just don't have the fuel load or the weather conditions to get much intensity, which is kind of what you need to knock back those red maples and beets and other species.
Yeah, I'll go ahead, John. You need to say something?
I was going to ask, is it even remotely possible to start thinking about this process being done with just a chainsaw alone? You have to have fire.
There are some people who will argue that you could do it with a chainsaw alone, but I think that there are other things that come into play. I think fire does, so not that competition, but it also prepares the seed bed, and it gets rid of fungal pathogens and pests and other things like that. And so I think periodic fire as a maintenance tool is something that you need in these forests in order to promote oak. But at the beginning, like if you've got a stand that hasn't seen fire in 50, 60, 70, 80 years, trying to put a fire back into it and expecting it to do anything for oak regeneration is probably not a good idea. You're going to have to do more than that. So I think you probably are going to have to open it up, but you've got to be careful not to open it up too much too fast, especially if you don't have some oak regeneration in the understory to begin with.
Yeah, we don't have much regeneration. We have a lot of deer browse, mainly New York fern, hay-scented fern growing in the understory with some beech whips whipping you in the face when you're bushwhacking. Right. And the overstory is going to be in some areas, some red oak, with those shade-tolerant red maple and sugar maple coming up underneath. That describes a large portion of our area.
Yeah, so, what we've done in some places, and it seems to have to work relatively well, is a similar situation where we've got a bunch of oaks in the overstory, and then we've got a ton of red maple, maybe winged elm, sweet gum, a lot of these just offside undesired species in the midstory. So we've done some hack and squirt work on those, sapling midstory stems to knock them back, open it up a little bit, try to get some increased growth in these little oaks that are hanging out in the understory. And then the goal is to, we haven't burned yet, but the goal is to burn it and then continue to burn for a while. And so I think that might be a good initial strategy, but eventually you've got to get light levels. It can't be that you only have 5% light in the understory for oaks to grow. You need more like 15-20%.
So it sounds like you're trying to prepare the advanced regeneration or get advanced regeneration to what? You're trying to dry things out, kind of like the reverse of what you're saying with what maples do with stem flow and through flow but earlier, right? I mean, is that what's going on?
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on. It's all about light, right? You want to open it up. You want to get light in there. Light not only promotes the growth of those oaks, but it dries out the leaf litter fuels. And then what could be most important is that it actually allows some herbaceous species to come into that understory. So then you can start propagating fire with multiple fuels, not just dead leaf litter fuels, but some live grass fuels, and help, you know, get a more contiguous fuel bed that will help spread fire and get some larger oaks in there. But, you know, it's tricky, too, because if you just have oak seedlings and they're tiny little guys, you're going to zap them with fire. They can't survive fire very well. So you need to open it up, get your oak regeneration bigger, and then burn it.
At what stage do you consider an oak established where it can take fire? What diameter?
I think it's about I can't remember the exact number. I'm not a silviculturist, so I don't have the numbers in my head. I think it's about an inch.
Okay.
Diameter.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, you know, fire, just like silviculture and cutting trees, should, you know, be used. The timing needs to be considered, the intensity. You can't just willy-nilly burn the landscape and expect oak. Is that what you're saying, or is it something else?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah. That makes sense. What do you think, John?
Yeah, I wish we can do it up here.
Yeah, right, John. Come on.
Try to get anyone to write you from the state to write you a burn plan in New York State. It's going to be a tough process. That's something we have to hurdle with first.
So I recently went to, well, I say recently, it was 2019. There was the Fire and Eastern Oak Forest Conference was in State College in Pennsylvania. Not too far from you guys.
No.
I mean, compared to Alabama anyway.
No, yeah, it's very similar. What, Pennsylvania?
Yeah, and they really struggled with getting fire back into their landscape for a long time, too. And so I don't think that they were doing prescribed fires there until it must have been like the late 90s. It hasn't been that long that they've been able to do it, but I was pretty impressed with their prescribed fire program and what the state had been able to do using, you know, a combination of tools to restore their oaks. And they have the same issues with deer and red maple just everywhere. And so I don't know, those guys might be somebody to look to for information on how to convince people to let you burn.
Yeah, parts of Pennsylvania are very similar, the Catskills with the fern and the red maple understory. They do have, I wonder if that was happening, those prescribed burns on game commission lands, because they have game lands there, and it's much different. They have DCNR, which is like their DEC, but then they have game lands that are paid for by hunters, and they manage those properties as far as I've seen.
Yeah, my first initial response was yes, but then I should take a step back because I don't fully remember. But yeah. Yeah, I mean, those guys were doing some cool stuff, and they had areas that had been decimated by gypsy moth, and they were, you know, dealing with like red maple going crazy and tons of fuels and trying to figure out how to get fire in that system, and it was pretty interesting.
So what do you think? Like, you know, parcel sizes here are decreasing. Average parcel size is probably 18 to 20 or so acres here in the Catskills. What do you think people should do? At the least, if they can't use fire, they have a few oaks. I mean, what do you do?
That's a really good question. So I would say, your overstory oaks are probably going to be fine. But if you're thinking about the next generation and you want to preserve oaks on your land, you've got to get some regeneration in there, which means probably you're going to have to remove some of this competition in the midst. And I would say, you know, even if you did this on 5 acres, maybe even less, you could do a hack and squirt, get rid of some of the red maple and American beech that's proliferating in that understory, open it up a little bit, and see if you can get some oak saplings to grow in the understory. It's really about life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, most of our jobs is about sunlight, right, John?
Yeah, we talk about it a lot.
So, you know, we're coming to the end. We only got 7 minutes left. If you could just summarize that mesophytic feedback loop, you know, because I think that's confusing to a lot of people.
Sure. So the mesophytic feedback loop starts with intentional fire suppression, which we as a country initiated in the early 90s, really coming into fruition about 1920, 1930. Basically, putting out any unintentional or, you know, no wildfires, stamp them out as they happen. So over time, without fire, lots of different trees started to come into the landscape because all trees are not created equal. Some of them like fiery environments and some of them don't. And the ones that don't like fiery environments also tend to like really shaded environments. And these are the ones that we are calling mesophytes or mesophytic species. And so those are the ones that started to connect. Red maple, sugar maple, blackberry, American beet. And they started to compete with species like oaks and pines that tend to like more open conditions. And over time, those species became more and more abundant across the landscape. As they became more and more abundant, they created a more shady forest understory, because they have dense canopies, lots of leaf area. They have leaves that have a different morphology, a different texture, a different chemistry. Their leaves tend to be thin and flat, lie on the forest floor in a way that holds moisture, doesn't create a lot of aeration, so it's a dampening effect. The litter also tends to decompose very quickly. And so those are conditions that suppress fire. Fire is not going to move their moist fuels and fuels that are very, very dense. And so they basically engineer an environment cooler, moister, shadier, without the ability to carry a fire. And over time, that continues to decrease the ability of these fire-loving species to be on the landscape. And so they're taking out light, they're making it less fiery, and so species that like fire are not able persist. And that's what we're seeing now across much of the eastern landscape.
It's pretty amazing, if nothing else, that there's a group of trees like these mesophytes that and oaks are doing the same thing, that engineer, as you just said, their perseverance, right?
Yeah. And I've been thinking a lot about this, and I really, you know, it's interesting to think that things are happening at the scale of an individual. A lot of time. You know, when you think about a tree, and, you know, you see this in people's yards when you walk through a neighborhood where the leaves are falling beneath that tree. You know, sometimes, like some trees will create like a mossy environment underneath them, and you'll see it almost like as a circle under it. Well, same thing's happening in a forest. It's just not as obvious because the tree zones are overlapping.
Yeah, Norway maple is extreme, right? I mean, what grows underneath there? Holy cow.
Not even grass.
Yeah. That's a good example, I think.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's talk is Fire Suppression and Mesophytication of Upland Oak Landscapes with Dr. Heather Alexander. What are some knowledge gaps, or where do you see this research going forward?
So some of the stuff that we've been doing recently is trying to figure out exactly how different species, those different oak species and different mesophytic species, control forest flammability through their traits. So we've been focused a lot on fuel in these systems.
Breaking up a little bit, maybe the window again.
Sorry. Is this any better?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so we're doing some cool studies where we're looking at how species differ in their traits and how those traits influence fire. So we've done experimental manipulations of the fuel bed out in the forest, going from, let's say, purely sweet gum to purely oak or purely pine, and then we set those cloths on fire and we measure fire behavior.
which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
We're going to start doing some work, I think, where we look at fire behavior around the different zones of influence of different trees. Because I have always thought that, like, you know, if you've got a red maple, decent-sized red maple tree or a clump of little red maple trees in the middle of the forest and you ignite a fire, like, what's going to happen when that fire gets to that red maple? You know, we think it's going to go out based on our laboratory studies and limited fuel plot studies, but it would be cool to do that in the forest. So we've been thinking about setting up some experiments where we implement fire and then track how fire behaves around these different trees to show, you know, that certain trees actually act to suppress fire in their immediate zone of influence.
So just to reiterate that, I think that's really important, is that you're doing a study where you're burning certain litter of, like, a maple versus a certain oak, like, say, red oak, and it burns differently.
Oh, yeah. It burns very... Yeah, it's cool because there are these small plots where we've taken off the natural litter, whatever would be down there normally, and then we put on known amounts of litter of different species, and then we use a drip torch to ignite them, and then we monitor how the fire moves across these plots. And, of course, it's not like a big spread fire, but still, it's pretty obvious when, you know, a fire, you put, lay down a drip torch line, and as soon as the fuel from the drip torch is gone, that sweet gum leaf litter just won't carry a fire at all.
That's pretty cool.
It's pretty cool. And then you watch Southern Red O, it just goes crazy, you know, so it's pretty obvious. And it seems intuitive, but it's pretty nice to have data to show it.
It's fun, if nothing else.
Oh, lots of fun.
We got about 15 seconds left. Is there anything you wanted to leave off on or people can find more information?
Yeah, so I want to give a plug for my colleague at the University of Florida who has a Fire University podcast, and we talked about this on there several months ago. And so if you just go to Fire University at the University of Florida, you'll find that. We published a paper in Bioscience on this topic, and so if anybody's interested in that, you can email me at heather.alexander@auburn.edu, and I'd be happy to share that with you.
All right. Thank you so much for taking the time and coming on tonight.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
All right, and the show will be archived by next week, and thanks again. Have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. If you missed the show, that was Dr. Heather Alexander from Auburn University talking about fire suppression and messification of upland oak. And have a good night.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Or whatever. From the forest, his tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way, getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games, in an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river runs down from the forest. With a mighty roar, the big jet soars above the canyon streets.
Brown men.